Yeah. All right, thanks. So I will give a tutorial today about tensor networks. Or, well, as Fernando knows, it's quantum tensor networks, which I think attaching the word quantum became more fashionable in the last 1 or 2 years in that context. To me, it feels a bit redundant. It's like saying quantum entanglement instead of entanglement, right? It's kind of the same thing. It doesn't make it more quantum by calling it quantum tensor networks. Anyway, it's a pretty broad field, and I have like only 90 minutes, so I'll try to be concise and, well, only sketch a couple of ideas. If you want to know more, feel free to interrupt me. If this would be a lecture on its own, I can propose to give a lecture on its own on that topic, or we discuss it later. But I'll certainly be happy to answer questions. I guess that's the idea of the whole format here. Okay, so the general theme is to try to describe, well, many body systems composed of many quantum constituents based on the structure of their entanglement. And so kind of the systems I will have in mind for this talk, but it's not really restricted to that. So kind of for simplicity, I will restrict to lattice systems. So what we will have is we will consider some kind of regular lattice of quantum systems which are composed of some spin. So this will be some D-level quantum systems. In the simplest case, D might be 2, so it's a spin 1/2 system. And well, the physics of these systems is governed by some kind of interactions, right? So we'll have some Hamiltonian, which say couples adjacent sites. It might also have some longer range. But typically, we expect these interactions to decay quite rapidly with the distance. I mean, the worst thing which could happen is Coulomb, but that's typically shielded. So in some effective theory describing a certain regime of a system, usually interactions will decay quite rapidly. So we have this system which is governed by some interactions which say could be nearest neighbor or local. So this will not be that important, but the main point is that we want a local Hamiltonian. In some sense, without a notion of locality, it doesn't even make sense to talk about a lattice, right? What does a lattice structure mean if everything interacts with everyone on the same footing? I mean, the lattice structure gives some notion of proximity, which is kind of mapped to some interaction strength. Now, I will stick to these kind of systems, but similar ideas we could, for instance, also apply to systems not consisting of spins, but of fermions, or for continuous theories with continuous space or field theories and so on. However, kind of the essential ideas are probably most clearly presented for the case of spin systems where there are less complications. And well, if you want, I can say something about generalizations later on. Okay, so what are we into? The other thing is, of course, that these kind of spin systems appear as effective theories in many areas, especially in condensed matter. But also, say, if you would take a quantum field theory and you would put it on a lattice, you would also get the lattice-based models. In that case, probably of fermions. But the lattice thing is certainly something which appears very naturally in many contexts. Okay, so what are we interested in? Well, we're interested in complex quantum phenomena in these systems. Or differently speaking, like if you look at kind of most of, many body physics, condensed matter physics, interactions are in the end not that important. We can use mean field theory. So in really many cases, a description based on something like mean field theory or kind of perturbations around mean field theory will actually quite well reproduce the essential features of these systems. Which kind of tells us that actually in a lot of systems in nature, entanglement is not all that important. It's kind of only a correction to some unentangled thing. So differently speaking, if we talk about mean field theory, what we're thinking of is that we describe the physics of our system as a wave function, which is kind of more or less a product state of separate states on each spin, which kind of, well, depending on how our Hamiltonian looks like might all be the same, or they might be opposite because it's an antiferromagnet, so every second spin would point in one direction and the other one the opposite, and so on. So it would be kind of safe to try to model the physics as something which doesn't have any entanglement, and then kind of we perturbatively, for instance, take into account effects of interactions. Now, that's not what we're interested in. We're interested in the other regime, in the regime where entanglement becomes important, so in the physics where the systems have strong interactions. So So for this talk, we're really interested in the regime where we have strong correlations, strong interactions. So we really have to think about the entanglement in the system. So that's like, you know, if you think of things like high temperature superconductivity, that's something which is very important, at least at the understanding. Things like the fractional quantum Hall effect and so on, all these effects, entanglement is very important. So they're very special effects, which we only find at low temperature and so on, but they're very exciting effects, so we want to understand them better. And for these effects, it's really not sufficient to look at a description like that and only take into account entanglement as a, well, as a correction, but we really have to start from an entanglement-based description of these systems. And so the primary focus in this talk will be to look at the low-energy physics. And the reason is that, A, from practice, we know that at low energies, these quantum effects are most prominent. So we look at low temperature. Well, first of all, at low temperature, these kind of strong quantum effects are most prominent. We kind of understand why. The reason is that at low temperature, entanglement is stronger. As we heat the system is mixed, and the more mixed it gets, the lower the entanglement gets. At some point, the thermal state can be described as some separable state. We know this from entanglement theory. So we really know that in this regime, we will have most entanglement, so that should be the most interesting regime. And some of the most entanglement we should really have at the lowest temperature, so at zero temperature. So what we want to study, first of all, are ground states of these systems. One reason is because they have the strongest entanglement. Another reason is that once we understand the ground state, we can start building excitations on top of the ground state. And it turns out in many of these kind of strongly correlated systems, a lot of the exciting properties of the low-lying ground states are actually coming from the structure, kind of the entanglement texture of the ground state itself. So the primary focus will be on, well, systems governed by local interactions, trying to understand what is the structure of their ground state. So what is the entanglement structure of ground states of local interactions? And well, here it turns out, well, if you look at these kind of questions, what people have considered is to take one of these lattice systems and, well, look at the ground state psi. So that's some ground state of some system with local interactions. And now we can ask, if we take a region in the system and ask what is the entanglement of that region with the rest, what we should do is we should take the reduced state in that region and compute something like the entropy or some kind of entropic quantity. So the entanglement of A with the rest, what is B, is basically given by the entropy of that region. And well, now it turns out that in these ground states, one can show that this property is very special. Namely, this property will behave like the boundary of that region. So it will scale like some constant times the boundary of that region, potentially with small corrections, but the basic effect is that the entanglement scales like the boundary, which is very special, because if you would just take a random quantum state and you would ask what's the entanglement in a random quantum state between the region and the rest, it will basically scale like the volume with just a very, very small subleading correction. So typically, we would expect volume. For ground states, what we see is we have a scaling which goes like the boundary. So this is what is known as the area law for the entanglement, because it's kind of a surface area. So I guess you have to think of 3D if you want to understand why it's called area and not boundary. And what this tells us is that the entanglement in these systems is kind of very special. So these systems have complex entanglement. We can't just think of them as unentangled states. But nevertheless, it's still very special. Namely, the entanglement is kind of located around the boundary. So we have degrees of freedom here entangled with degrees of freedom outside in some way. That's probably not an accurate description. But the point is that the entanglement is concentrated around the boundary. Concentrated. So the idea would be to build a description of these wave functions, of these states, based on the fact that there should be entanglement, but the entanglement should be distributed locally. Now you might wonder, why is the entanglement distributed locally? And well, one thing is that, of course, what the Hamiltonian itself imposes is local constraints, so to say. Right? Say we have a Heisenberg interaction, a Heisenberg antiferromagnetic interaction. This interaction would like adjacent spins to be in a singlet state, so to them to be entangled. Now we know that we can't entangle all states simultaneously in singlet state, so there's a competition, and that's why the ground fit is complex and not just a simple entangled state. But the fact that the Hamiltonian will always only try to entangle adjacent states, so indeed adjacent entanglement is preferred over long-range entanglement, which is kind of a higher order effect, if you wish, which comes from competing Hamiltonian interactions. Yes?
So here, the area that you're taking is sort of like, I mean, that length there is larger than the interaction in your Hamiltonian.
Well, that's indeed a scaling law, right? I mean, you want that for large regions, the scaling should go like the boundary. So it doesn't make much sense to ask the question for a fixed region, right? So one really has to kind of scale that region. I mean, you should fix the shape, right? One could argue that maybe, you know, there's more horizontal than vertical entanglement. So in principle, you would like to fix the shape and grow that thing and see how it scales.
From the way that you have set it up, you went to the vacuum to get the most entanglement.
Mm-hmm.
Now we see that it's got maximally entangled on this local scale. Mm-hmm. So if you heated the system up, the expectation is that there's less entanglement but more
You could expect, of course, that you heat a bit and the entanglement goes up, right? There's no theorem saying that the entanglement goes down immediately once you heat. It's just saying as you approach a high temperature state, say a maximum mixed state, the entanglement will go down eventually.
Okay, so
the other thing is, if you look at a low temperature state which has few excitations, you can probably understand it starting from the ground state and then putting a low density of excitations. Right? I mean, kind of the mess starts once the excitations interact with each other. So if you have a low density.
It seems to be overshot by going to the vacuum.
Kind of. It's also a more well-defined question, right? If I look for a low-lying excited state, it gets much more complicated, especially if it's not a thermal state, but I look at specific excitations. So sometimes that's also the simplest question.
I feel like it's not clear, but are you talking about the pure states of a system, of the Hamiltonian or the mixed state? You're probably talking about mixed states. That's why you said that at high temperature you have low entanglement, right? Because we had in mind some thermal in-minus beta. If you're talking about pure states, obviously they are much more entangled than the ground state. They have volume more entanglement.
Oh, that's true, yes. Indeed.
So if you're talking about the mixed states, then perhaps one can see when you heat it up, perhaps. But then you have to define what you mean by entanglement.
I would prefer not to define what I mean by entanglement,
okay,
because that would be an own lecture. But there are various notions of entanglement for mixed states, right? For instance, you can ask, like, what's the minimal amount of pure state entanglement, at least on average, to make this mixture. I mean, it's more a hand-wavy argument, right? It's
okay.
Kind of the choices, do you give a motivation or not? If you give one, it's hand-wavy, then the risk is that people ask the details. No, it's a good question, I agree. So it's two motivations. It's kind of supposed to be one of the, maybe the ground state should be the most quantum one of kind of the, say, simple states of the system, like equilibrium states and so on. And it will also contain kind of information about the excitations. So if I'm interested in the low energy physics, it's probably a good idea to first start from the ground state and then look at the low energy physics. So that's kind of the motivation.
So I guess in the mean field case, it would be the same, right?
Say again?
In this case, in the uninteresting case, mm-hmm, it would still be
zero. Oh, yeah. Well, it's zero, right?
It's not exactly zero.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, it's not exactly zero once you... That's true. But from the mean field ansatz itself, it's zero. But indeed, you should kind of correct it. And that will not be exactly zero. I agree. I mean, it's obviously the mean field case should be contained in that case because I'm discussing the general scenario. Kind of the question would be, is there a way to kind of extend the approach of describing the ground state or approximating the ground state in a way which captures these correlations in a more accurate way, a more rich way? Okay. Introduce tensor networks yet? Talk 15 minutes. Okay, so what we want is kind of an ansatz which maybe, well, it should have some features. One feature is it should I mean, mean field really in this product and that without any entanglement is actually not so bad, right? Like you get correlation functions out of that, you get low-lying excitation spin waves out of that, and so on. So actually, even not putting any entanglement is kind of a good answer. So we might actually want to generalize it in a way which allows us to add entanglement, and which maybe hopefully allows us to go beyond just adding it in a perturbative way, right? So how do we do that? So what we have is that, well, the most general, I mean, maybe I should say the overall idea is to kind of have a variational approach, right? To have a way of kind of specifying the wave function and then trying from that wave function to explain the physics of the system. So, well, if we have this spin system of n spins, well, the overall way to describe the wave function would basically just be to specify this expansion coefficient. But the problem is, of course, that this here has, well, small d to the n coefficients. So it's this exponentially big object, which John also mentioned in his lecture yesterday, right? That's this exponentially big Hilbert space. And kind of what we want, of course, is a way not to describe the full thing. I mean, that would, of course, be a way of describing all these states, but that space is far too big, right? So what we really want is we want a way of describing the physically relevant states. And as we have seen, these states are singled out by their special entanglement structure, right? They have a relatively little entanglement in the sense of saying that the entanglement is only always located at the boundaries of regions. So how should we go and generalize mean field in a way which gives us that entanglement? So maybe let me start with one-dimensional system. So if I take a mean field ansatz, well, I have this ansatz here. And what I can do is I can take this state phi, I can just expand it in a basis. And then what I will see that this expansion coefficient is just a product of these numbers. It's AI1 times AI2 times AIN, right? So, well, I just have a vector for each spin, and these vectors contribute in a completely uncorrelated way to this weight. So how can we generalize it in a way which correlates them across adjacent sites? Well, one simple way of doing that is putting a matrix here instead of a number. So let me put some matrices here. Well, maybe take the trace. I could also take 1 by n matrices on the side. So each of these AIs is a capital D by D matrix. And so what has happened is that basically, this suddenly allows me to build up some kind of non-trivial correlations, right? What matrix I will put here. So for each physical state here, right, that's each of these states goes from 1 to d. So for each possible choice I have for the physical system at that site, I will put a matrix, which means that, well, suddenly correlations can enter, right? If I put a different matrix here, this matrix will see different boundary conditions, so something different will happen, right? It will get a different weight, a different number here. What you also see there is some built-in notion of locality, right? If I change this matrix here, a matrix far away will most likely see much less of this change. It's not a rigorous argument, and it might indeed see something, but it's kind of more distant, right? So the effect should be more indirect, which we see. All right, so this is what is called a matrix product state. So what you would have is that we would have a state which has this form here. Where, again, these AIs are, each of these AIs is a D by D matrix. And this D here is called the bond dimension, usually. Is the definition clear? Yes?
Are you thinking about a one-dimensional?
Right now, yes. Oh, I said it. Did I write it? I wanted to write it.
Right, okay.
Sorry. I wanted to, I said it, I wanted to write it, and then decided to write something different.
No, you wrote it. It's there.
Oh, sorry. Where?
On the left.
Oh, on the left. Right. Yes, two. I started off furious. Okay, so now usually we won't write these formulas, but we will kind of, so okay, what did we do in some sense? In some sense, we took this very complicated object here. So it's a single tensor with n indices. And we re-expressed it as some kind of formula where we multiply together a number of different tensors. So each of these is a d by d by small d. That's a physical dimension tensor. So it's a three-index tensor. So what we did is we took an n-index tensor. And we re-expressed it as a number n of three-index tensors. So in particular, this has d to the n parameters. Now, each of these guys has a constant number of parameters, capital D squared times small d squared parameters. So we managed to change our scaling from something which would go, well, if they're all the same, actually, we only have, there's no factor of n. But in principle, we could imagine having different tensors here with some extra superscript, in which case we might have a different number of tensors. But in any case, we managed to change our scaling in n from exponential to something linear or maybe even constant if we choose all these tensors the same. We have a new parameter here, which is a parameter which allows us to enlarge the class of states we can describe. So that's kind of some variational parameter, if you wish. Well, how should I call it, not variational? Let me call it variational, that looks better.
It's not the thing which is being varied.
Do we have a good name? Just nothing comes to my mind. It's kind of a parameter which allows to enlarge the class of states. So it's a hierarchical parameter. It's like a family of states. Let me just write family of states. So in particular, if I choose d equal 1, I just reproduce mean field. And once I increase d, I get more and more states, which hopefully can have more and more correlations. Especially, I can always embed a small matrix in a big matrix. So if I make D larger, I get a strictly larger class of states. Okay, so now usually what we will do is to facilitate notation, we will denote tensors by boxes. So the big tensor C will be denoted by a big box with n legs, so each index here is a leg. Each leg is an index for the tensor. And then we will take these tensors A and also denote them by boxes. So what I will do is that this index I is the index labeling the physical spin. Then I have indices alpha and beta, which label the matrix indices of that matrix. So this one is a capital D-dimensional index, and that's a small d-dimensional index here. And now what we will do is that whenever we multiply indices, and well, multiplying matrices is kind of just, you know, making the indices identical, summing over them. So whenever we do that, we will connect these indices. So what this depicts here is a matrix multiplication. So what I would have here is I would have AI1 alpha beta, AI2 beta gamma. And connecting these legs means that both of these indices are supposed to be beta, and I'm summing over that index beta. So what I do if I take this full matrix product, I will just connect these legs and then put some periodic boundary conditions for the trace. So that's kind of a graphical depiction of what's going on. We're taking this big tensor C here, which is exponentially big objects, and we are re-expressing it as a contraction, a summation, over a number of much smaller tensors, which, well, I always use A, so you might think they're the same, and one can choose them the same. But one could also choose them differently, in which case, again, one would have this factor of N in the number of parameters. Okay, is that roughly clear? Okay. Now, so, what you see is, again, I mean, this index kind of builds up correlations, right? It builds up entanglement, if you wish, between adjacent sites. So it seems, indeed, there's some local correlation structure built into the whole thing. Now, once you have the graphical notation, you can kind of see that this is not specific to one dimension, but one can try to make a very similar construction in higher dimensions.
Can I ask them before you go to higher dimensions? The fact that you're just multiplying these things doesn't mean that you have any entanglement, right? You could have an identity or something that wouldn't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
So it's.
I mean, you can think of some cartoon things. You could, for instance, think that you have an A. Which is of the form delta I1 beta. And A does something, I don't know, delta A0. Mm-hmm. And then you choose a B on the next side. And I will multiply them, so let me call this beta, which is of the form delta I2 beta and delta gamma 0. And now I can put these two together, pretty much regardless of what I put on the left and on the right. So now if you evaluate this, what you see is you have to put these two deltas together and sum over beta. So what you will get is that you get a sum over delta I1, I2 times, well, something for alpha and gamma, right? So what does this correspond to? It means that these two indices are equal and can take all possible values, which means that you have built basically a maximally entangled state, right? If you plug this back into a formula with these coefficients, this would describe a state which has some form, sum I1, I2, times something on the rest, whatever I glue to that. So you see, it's very clear that you can build, say, for instance, maximally entangled states. Or say what you could do is if that's a four-level system, you could split it into two-level systems, entangling one with the right and one with the left. So what you can certainly build is these cartoon states, but you can also build more, right? You can start to smear out the entanglement.
So the idea is, it can do the job that you expect, and then you sort of optimize mm-hmm. for it to do the job.
Exactly. I wanted to indeed to say something about kind of approximation results and then about optimization. So just from this pure kind of geometric picture of building up correlations locally, we can do something similar in 2D. So we could choose a tensor which has five legs, so again some physical leg, and some auxiliary legs. And then we could try to do something very similar. We could try to build a two-dimensional grid, say on a square lattice, out of these tensors, in a way where maybe we take periodic boundary conditions. We could also choose different boundary conditions, right? There's no need to choose periodic boundary conditions. We could just terminate it with some vector here, or omit this index and just choose a two-index object at the boundary. There's quite a lot of flexibility. So one can do this in 2D and, of course, in different geometries and so on. So this is what is also known as projected entangled pair states for reasons I'm not going to explain. Okay. So I've kind of motivated these constructions from the locality notion, so just saying I try to kind of build up correlation through contracting tensor indices according to some geometry. But one can indeed show approximability results. And the idea is kind of to start from thermal states. So to say, okay, let me try to look at something like e to the minus beta h. And when it's e to the minus beta h, what would be an intuition? An intuition would, I mean, if I want a ground state, I can try to get something like that with some large enough beta, right? That should get me close to the ground if I apply this operator to some initial state, which is has little entanglement. So one question is, how much entanglement does this operation generate? And well, we can try to do something like a Trotter decomposition, right? And so on. So we could try to kind of slowly cool to the ground state, right, by applying either the even lattice set operators or the odd lattice set operators. And in some sense, each of these operations can be understood as, say, if I have a one-dimensional spin chain, I can first, say, apply even set operators, which are e to the minus epsilon h. And then I can apply odd set operators. And so forth. And the point is that each of these guys will generate little entanglement. So I can, again, try to take each of these guys and write it as some two tensors, A and B, and some extra entanglement. So I'm just doing a decomposition of this operator, if you wish, some singular value decomposition of that operator, which will build up some entanglement between these sides. And I can try to do this everywhere. So what I get this way is indeed that I rewrite this imaginary time evolution with a lot of tensors. And now I can basically say, okay, let me collapse this tensor network. So let me block all tensors in one column to one big super tensor. And what I will get is exactly one kind of one-dimensional structure with some tensors, where kind of this dimension here is the collapse dimension of all steps in the imaginary time evolution. Now, that's probably not a smart idea, because I need to trotterize a lot to get a good accuracy, right? So I would need a large dimension. On the other hand, if I trotterize a lot, each of these operations is actually very close to the identity, right? So it doesn't use much correlations in the other sense. So it turns out that from this intuition, one can actually compress these operations and get an efficient approximation of thermal states. Alternatively, we can actually use Taylor expansion, which is slightly more powerful but less intuitive. But the intuition somehow behind the whole reasoning is why this is a good framework to approximate these operators is that one can start basically by doing a Trotter decomposition and slowly, step by step, doing this imaginary time evolution and rewrite this as some tensor network with some very big dimension here, which, however, can be compressed. Now, this is not a matrix product state. This would be a matrix product operator, or MPO. But the philosophy is exactly the same, right? You have a one-dimensional structure of an operation, which hopefully doesn't need too much entanglement. And now I could apply this to a product state and get a state which would be this applied to a product state, which is, if the temperature is low enough, will be close to the ground state. So what does one get?
You just tie those bottom row of legs to some arbitrary
Well, you should choose it wisely so it has sufficient. Okay, so what do we need? So first of all, we have approximation result for thermal state. Let me maybe just give the result and then say what you do for the pure state, okay? So this works in any dimension. So if I have a thermal state, I can well approximate it with some tensor network operator, like with lower and upper legs, with a cost. Well, how do I measure the cost? Well, with this bond dimension, d here, which scales like system size divided by the accuracy I want. And that's a global distance, so it's a pretty good accuracy, to the power of something like a constant times beta. So it means as long as I'm aiming for a not too low temperature, it's actually not so bad. So now if I want to get ground states.
Is there assumption on the density of states here?
Here? No. The assumption enters the second step if I want to get ground states, right? So once I want to get ground states, the question is to what temperature do I have to go to get sufficient overlap with the ground state if I start from a more or less random state? And well, on the other hand, I want an efficient scaling. So the question is, like, under which condition will it scale efficiently? And the point is that we would like to have be this maybe log n, then it scales a bit faster than polynomial, but not much faster than n. So that'd be far below exponential. And it turns out that this is good enough if the density of state scales nicely, which means polynomially rather than exponentially.
Well, it's a question of the high energy density of states?
No, the low energy density of states, more or less.
Can you be more...
Well, not really low. I mean the whole thing, right? I think you want the whole density of states from the beginning to the end. So the point is, if you have a gap and then you have particle-like excitations, like a band structure, this condition will hold. Mm-hmm. If your gap is, it will not hold. If your gap... I don't think there's a single example which doesn't have this. Well, actually, there's one example which has a coupling term which scales inversely with the system size, which I guess is considered cheating in a practical context. Yeah?
So can you connect this to some of the other ideas about strongly coupled materials, like that there might be a quantum critical point in the infrared? Do we know something about the entanglement structure given that assumption?
Well, as I said, this condition should hold in whenever you're gapped, right? And
so, okay, but I thought you were aiming for these systems that remain active and strongly coupled as you go to the infrared.
Yeah. I'm not sure I see the connection.
Okay, I thought you said something about high TC and you wanted to show
something. I'm not sure it necessarily relates to quantum critical points, right?
I'm just wondering...
Which is if there's non-trivial long-range entanglement, right, which these systems indeed can have.
I just wanted to know if you can test that idea using these methods or if there's any connection.
Well, you can use it for numerics for sure.
But you're saying if the system you're trying to simulate is gapless, then this is useless?
No. I mean, these are rigorous mathematical bounds. In practice, these things work much better.
Oh, I see.
And people simulate critical systems with these methods, right? So it does work. Like, I mean, they don't have the strict area law scaling and so on. I mean, these are rigorous analytical bounds, I should say. I'm just not giving a rigorous formula, but actually these are rigorous bounds. I'm kind of mixing things, which usually makes Toby very upset. Are you upset? No, you look happy. Toby tends to complain that in my talks I don't make clear what's rigorous and what's not, and he doesn't care if it's rigorous or not, but he thinks I should make it clear. So these are actually rigorous bounds, I should say. Practically, if you do numeric things, we'll scale much better usually, right? Yes?
I'm just confused about what the statement is here. So suppose I want to, given some Hamiltonian, I want to calculate expectation value of some operator at temperature beta inverse.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying that with this much bond dimension, I can calculate an exact, with some, so what's the difference between the exact answer and the one which you get from it? What is the difference?
Epsilon, for any observable, in fact. So this epsilon is a trace norm distance. If you want to be mathematically rigorous, it tells you you have a matrix product operator with dimension d, which from the normalized e to the minus beta h has trace norm distance, which is something which bounds any the expectation value of any observable with operator norm 1.
So that's a catch, that if I want good small epsilon, that's why we don't do this generally. I mean, that's the reason that it doesn't work, right?
Say again?
If I want a good answer, I want the epsilon to be very small, and that's why this fails to do. For example, suppose I want to solve some two-dimensional system, which has sine problem. Take any power model in two dimensions.
Oh, wait, I mean, this has nothing to do with the sine problem, right? I mean, right now I'm just talking how well does this ansatz perform in approximating the ground state. I have no way of finding it. It might be impossible to find that description.
I'm just saying take some interesting problem for which we don't know the answer. Take some Hubbard model in two dimensions. Why? You're saying you can solve it using this pattern.
I didn't say that. As I said, I'm saying that this ansatz can approximate the ground state to a certain accuracy. There's no way of finding. Look, classical spin glasses. A product state can approximate the ground state to error zero. It doesn't mean you can solve it.
No, I'm not interested in the ground state. Let's say beta is order one. Let's say.
Okay.
Then I'm interested in calculating thermal correlation functions of, let's say, three-dimensional Hubbard model. My understanding is that the accuracy that you need is obviously is epsilon, and epsilon is small, so that's why it doesn't work.
Same answer to the thermostat question.
I think it's the same answer. I'm making an existence statement, right? It's a statement like saying, "Oh, this is well." How should I rephrase it? Okay. Again, let me try to restate what I said about classical spin glasses. They're hard, right? They're very hard. A trivial statement is that the product ansatz will capture the ground state to epsilon equals zero accuracy, right? This doesn't tell you anything about how to solve it. Nothing.
The problem is you can't find rho d.
Well, it depends on the problem, right? At least I didn't make any statement about that yet. That's exactly the point, right? Statement one I'm trying to go stepwise. Question one is it a good class of states to describe these states, like low energy states of local Hamiltonians? And the answer is yes. There are rigorous results, and also in practice you see it works, and typically much better than that. Also, that's a very, very tough figure of merit. It's a global distance, right? If you look for local observables, a much weaker approximation might suffice. But step two is, can I find it? And then it depends on the problem, right? There might be very glassy problems where this might be hard. There might be problems where that's easy. Then whether it relates to the sign problem, that's a different question, but it's not clear how to find this, right? It could be very tricky.
But for spin glassy behaviors, sometimes it's in some NP hard or something, but here, is there any understanding how hard is it to find it?
For the Hubbard model, probably no. For other problems, yes.
For some class of problem, are there any...
No, I mean, we have some hardness results on these things. I mean, obviously, you can just take a classical spin glass, right, and ask, can I approximate the thermostat of a classical spin glass in that language? Obviously, yes, even with d equal 1, but it's hard to find, because we know it's NP hard, so we can't devise a provably efficient method. Maybe not even a practically efficient method if it's NP hard. So it's several steps. Okay, let me just state that there's some stronger results for... So for 1D, actually, one can prove it more directly based on the gap. So gap implies that we can efficiently approximate these guys. Well, efficient basically, again, means a polynomial scaling in N over epsilon. So in practice, of course, the gap will enter kind of as a prefactor in this polynomial, right? If the gap is small, you need to go to much larger d, because d captures the amount of entanglement, so you expect d to be exponentially larger in the entanglement, and, the entanglement should go, like, inverse of the gap or something like that.
Well, but I think I forgot what n was here.
At some point, I mentioned it, like here. So n is a system size, right? I mean, the reason why the system size enters intuitively is that we want a global approximation. With a local one, you might do without the system size. It's just it's much harder to derive bounds analytically which don't carry the system size.
So this PEPS is kind of designed to have an area law.
Exactly, I should have stressed that, yes. I mean, one way of looking at that, you say, oh, these kind of ansatzes are designed to have an area law, in the sense that, you know, you cut any region in the system, and you ask, where does the entanglement of that region with the rest come from? Well, it can only come from the indices which cross the boundary, right? Each of them is a summation index. So if you try to decompose this in some kind of Schmidt decomposition, sum of, you know, inside, because the inside A and the outside B, you do a decomposition, the summation index is indeed, must be only these indices, right? Because there are no other indices connecting degrees of freedom in the inside and the outside. So you see the amount of entanglement can at most scale like the boundary. But on the other hand, kind of what these results tell you is that it's actually also sufficient to describe these systems. Well, not systems with, in 1D systems with area laws. So in 1D, the result really works that you say gap, area law, efficient approximation. You could go directly, but you can go via the area law. In 2D, what we know is that we have low energy states of local Hamiltonians. We can describe them. Now, it could be that the area law states, which are not counted, that's very likely, which are not counted of local Hamiltonians. But even more, I think we have no result which tells us that once we have an area law, we can get a description of that kind. Doesn't say it's wrong. We don't have a counterexample either. But that's actually an open question. Now, it might be that the area law is actually not, well, probably the area law is not the right way of characterizing ground states of 2D Hamiltonians. Because the area law, in 1D, it's very strict, right? It tells you have a chain, the entanglement is here. That's really a local property. In 2D, it only tells you, oh, the entanglement is kind of smeared out here. But it doesn't tell you how it's smeared out. And that's probably undershooting, right? You want to have a stronger result. You really want to know it's distributed kind of locally, presumably. So the 2D result seems, I mean, the area law in 2D doesn't seem to be to capture the full picture. It just gives you the intuition. But there should be more to the entanglement structure of 2D systems.
Is the issue that when we say area law, we're fixing the shape? You're not allowed to change the shape, but somehow we want something stronger where it's actually proportional to the area with a proportionality that's somehow independent of the shape. That makes it kind of more local along the...
Well, maybe that would be a next step. I mean, what I'm trying to say is that what we want somehow, at least intuitively, is to say that the entanglement, if we think about ground states, right, we want to say the entanglement is distributed locally. In 1D, an area law exactly tells us it's distributed locally. In 2D, it doesn't really tell us that. But at least you could imagine that there's a weird way of smearing out the entanglement, so it's not local, but it still has an area law scaling. Now, in the end, of course, the area law is kind of just an intermediate tool, essentially, to relate ground states of local Hamiltonians with such a description. So it might be we don't need it, right? This result indeed tells us we can kind of skip over that part, but it's a nice motivation to say why the ansatz has that structure. But I mean, this structure uses more. It really uses that the correlation we built up locally, not just across borders. I mean, it might be that if you put area laws in all possible, I think what you can prove is if you have a strict area law in any possible shape, like this one, with a fixed constant, then I think you can prove you get this ansatz. It might even work with a very small epsilon correction to the area law, if it scales quickly enough to zero. Now, you might say that's not very natural to have this area law with the same constant for every shape, because you have corner contributions and stuff. But if you have it exactly, I think you can use this recovery map arguments, which I think were mentioned in one of the earlier talks to construct such a state. But in some sense, I think the area law is only an intermediate step, right? What we really care about is kind of local interactions and their ground states, thermal states, and so on. Yes?
Isn't another problem that this connection doesn't hold, that the area law is expressed in terms of the von Neumann entropy, which is kind of an average, whereas here...
I think if you have it exactly, it works, right, as I said, but otherwise, yeah.
If you have it exactly.
An exact area law, right? I think then you can make a connection.
Yes, but still the von Neumann entropy could consist of a contribution of something that is completely smeared out, small probability, but still reasonable probability.
I mean, I agree that from a quantum information point of view, there is somehow no reason to use von Neumann entropies for measuring entanglement in many body systems, right? Because kind of the whole interpretation of the von Neumann entropy as an entanglement measure is to say that you have many copies of something, you operate jointly on them, and then you try to extract the entanglement, which there's no motivation for that in a quantum measure setting. So probably one might want to use some epsilon smooth rank or something like that.
But I guess one has to, in the sense, I mean, here it's really strict. I mean, you have a number of bond dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of a fixed number, not an average.
So you mean averages have a spatial smeared out, or spatial smearing out, or what?
In terms of probabilities, like you cannot have the state where with some small probability you still have a larger bond dimension.
Oh.
That's why the phenomenon cannot imply.
I mean, actually what we know, I was cheating a little bit, this 1D argument saying gap implies area law implies approximability indeed uses area laws for Renyi entropies with Renyi index strictly smaller than 1. Because the phenomenon entropy is exactly at the edge where it just doesn't work.
Then it's exactly no longer an average for the...
Yeah. You can indeed set up, that's probably a good point, you can indeed set up counter examples which have an area law for the von Neumann entropy, which are not translation invariant, which indeed violate this implication. So the scaling will not be polynomial, but kind of somewhere, it's not strictly exponential, but it's over polynomial. And what you have to do, I mean, you have to also break translation invariant, so indeed it depends that things are distributed non-uniformly. But yes.
And it'll be hard to construct a gapped Hamiltonian with that.
Second?
It'll be hard to construct any Hamiltonian with that as a ground.
I have to look back at this example. I remember it had some long-range entanglement, yes. Well. It was clearly a wave function constructed to see if that connection holds, so it's probably not a ground state. And we kind of know that for gapped ground states, indeed, also the Renyi entropies have an area law, which then again is enough. Okay.
In 1D.
Uh-huh. Okay. Okay, I didn't want to talk much about numerical methods, but let me just mention, well, because this lambda is well suited to this, to approximate ground states, and in practice even much better, one can use it as a variational ansatz for simulations. So the most well-known method is probably the density matrix renormalization group method, DMRG, which is basically a variational method over the class of matrix product states. And the reason why this works nicely is basically if I have a tensor network with a number of tensors, which are site-dependent, and I pick one of the tensors, I keep the others fixed, and I ask, well, how does a state behave as a function of one of these tensors A2, then this is a linear function, right? So it means that if I variationally try to optimize the energy as a function of that tensor, say, divided by the normalization, this is a quadratic problem, right? And quadratic problems can typically be solved efficiently. It's an eigenvalue problem. So this can be mapped to an eigenvalue problem. And then one can iteratively solve this by fixing all other tensors, picking one tensor, optimizing that one, and sweeping through the system. Now, again, that doesn't work provably, but in practice it works very well. It can get stuck in local minima because it's a local optimization, but with a few tricks, these methods actually work very well, especially in 1D. Okay. Time is running. I got one page out of four.
Were you going to say anything about the practical applicability of TUFs?
I wasn't intending so much. So my plan was to talk a bit about how to construct solvable models in this framework and how to understand some bulk boundary correspondence, entanglement spectra, and so on, and how to understand symmetries. I'm not sure that all fits.
But can you just say one sentence about, I mean, are they useful in higher D? I mean,
they're useful in higher D. There are people who work with that in two dimensions. I mean, it's more difficult, but it does work. I mean, some people got very good results in 2D more recently. Say, in the TJ model and frustrated spin systems and so on. So also beating existing models, or actually also understanding models which hadn't been understood previously with other methods.
I see, but it's not kind of just, it's more case by case than 1D.
I mean, in 1D, that's really the method of choice, basically, as like to simulate basically all kind of 1D systems. In 2D, it's more depends on the situation, right? I mean, if you don't have a sign problem, Monte Carlo would probably be the best method. That's really more in the case where Monte Carlo has issues because of sign problems and so on, from Linux systems and so on. Well, it's also about gaining experience, right? The 2D methods are fairly new compared to the 1D methods, and it takes a while to build up enough experience to know how to do all these kind of extrapolations and so on. Like you have this finite bond dimension D here, right? So you need to extrapolate in D going to infinity, if you wish, to get reliable estimates. For which one needs some experience to know how to do these extrapolations. And in 1D, people have a lot of experience how to extrapolate in D. And in 2D, this still is being built up. But there's been a lot of progress in the last couple of years. And it's definitely computationally much more intense than 1D. And it involves kind of an extra layer of approximation, usually, in the computation and so on.
Because of the contractions?
Because of the contraction. I mean, in 1D, if you want to compute expectation values, you kind of go from left to right, so you keep multiplying matrices of fixed size, which you can do exactly. In 2D, you basically go, say, also from left to right, but you have to basically work again on a 1D chain. So kind of the method works by dimensional reduction, right? In 1D, you go to 0D, which is constant. You can deal with it. In 2D, you go to 1D, but the 1D thing is still hard to deal with. So you basically nest another layer of DMRG into it. So you're nesting the method twice, basically. I don't think anyone has ever really attempted 3D, because then you have to nest it another time. So it's kind of challenging.
One question. Yes. So you wrote down this result in general dimensional, I guess, the thermal state, the n over epsilon to the power c. Is it in 1D or in general dimension?
That's in any dimension.
So then
it's dimension independent.
Suppose I have a gap system in bigger than 1D, let's say 2 dimensions or 3 dimensions, if my beta is bigger than just the gap, let's say, I mean, isn't it correct that I don't need to take beta to be, let's say, log n, right? If it's a gap system, Veda is
much more. No. But I mean, you can compute kind of where your state will be, but it's kind of a typicality argument. You have a certain temperature, so you get a Boltzmann distribution. You have to multiply it with the density of states, and the thing will have a peak somewhere. Now, if your system gets bigger, the density of states will get wider and wider, right? Because they're just more states. So your weight will shift up if you keep a temperature fixed.
System.
Sorry? No, but in a gapped system, right, the density of states will have an independence in a total system. So at a fixed temperature, you will get to a higher and higher average occupation.
Isn't it correct if the temperature is less than the gap, then you will approximate ground states fairly well?
No. But again, I mean, it's really, you just take the density of states, right, and then you take a Boltzmann distribution, and this thing gets wider and this one doesn't. So your kind of peak of the product of the two will shift up. I mean, there's a gap, right? So if your Boltzmann distribution, if this is narrow, I mean, the Boltzmann is fixed, if this is narrow enough, your peak will be here, or well, in the ground state, actually. But at some point, it will shift up.
Maybe it's about like.
At the end, there's one state here and infinitely many states here, right? So regardless how small their weight is compared to this constant weight, they will dominate at some point.
You want a global approximation, that's why. So, like, if you want to approximate the mean ground state energy, then what you say is correct.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to get the global state right, then.
Not just in the global, let's say just the local.
If you're looking for intrinsic quantities, it's
in
right.
Local, yes. It might work, but.
Right.
It's like, you know, some magnetization or something, right?
Yes, let's say just global. So then, in that case, the D is polynomial in NOA epsilon.
Well, these results don't apply in that case, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think morally it's probably correct, yes. Okay. Oof. Far too much material. What should I do? Okay, so what... Okay, let me just say a few sentences about solvable models. So one thing I mentioned is that tensor networks can be used to approximate ground states. One can do the converse thing, and that's kind of interesting. One can, given a tensor network, one can construct what we call apparent Hamiltonian, which has this tensor network as an exact ground state. And the idea is kind of that if I have a tensor network, say a one-dimensional network, it is possible to design a Hamiltonian which kind of ensures that if I'm in a ground state of that Hamiltonian, the tensor network will look locally correct. So what we do is we build some local Hamiltonian, say two-body, so it means that any state which could be locally written like it's built from these tensors with anything outside of it will be a ground state. There could be more ground states, but certainly the original thing will be a ground state. And we can do the same in 2D. We can build a tensor network if we have some 2D state. It's always possible to build an operator, say, which looks on a small patch, say 2x2. And whenever I'm in a ground state, I know that my system is exactly built from these tensors and nothing else on that small patch. Now, it could be that globally there's still an obstruction, or which kind of allows for others, sorry, not obstruction, but that globally there are more than one possible assignment for the wave function. But at least the original wave function, built only from the original tensors, will always be a ground state. So one can use this to construct kind of solvable models where one would basically start from some tensor, get some Hamiltonian, and at the same time get a ground state wave function. And well, one important thing I will get there is that if I encode certain symmetries into the tensor, I will get these symmetries in the Hamiltonian. So I can get certain Hamiltonians which have certain symmetries, a certain structure, and build models which I can study exactly. So you might have heard of the AKLT model, which is one specific model of that kind. I could say more about it, but I'd rather postpone it to later if there's interest to learn more about these constructions. So I think maybe also in the general context, let me talk a bit about bulk boundary correspondence and entanglement spectra and so on. Is that okay? And then I can talk a bit about symmetries and kind of structure theorems without giving the full theorem. So bulk boundary correspondence. I'm a bit hesitant to call it holographic because it's slightly different from what I guess people in gravity consider holographic duality. So what is it about? Well, first of all, it's about entanglement properties and entanglement spectra. So one thing people have studied, well, this was studied by Lee and Haldane, to better understand the topological nature of, well, in that case, topologically ordered systems. But one could generally think about better understanding the structure of strongly entangled systems, is to take a wave function and cut it, well, let's put it on a cylinder, because it makes a nicer boundary. Cut it into two halves, so we have some wave function, which is some ground state wave function, and we would have a left part and a right part. And now we can write it in the Schmidt decomposition, right? So we would have some lambda I, left I, right I. And now we can think of these lambdas as basically some Gibbs weights. So we would write e to the minus hi, or ei. So we would have some pseudo energies, ei here. And we can also assign quantum numbers, actually, to these Li. So whenever our overall wave function has some quantum number, it will certainly have momentum, say, around the cylinder. So we have some ky, or just k. So we can assign some momentum. But we can also assign other quantum numbers, like spin, etc. And then we can look at these spectra. That's what Lee and Haldane did for the fractional quantum Hall wave function, and what they found is that this resembles some CFT structure of some 1D CFT. So in the case of the fractional quantum Hall effect, this resembles a 1D CFT structure, so they kind of conjecture that there would be some kind of entanglement Hamiltonian, which would this tell us how this entanglement spectrum looks like. And it turned out that this entanglement Hamiltonian, the CFT corresponding to that, actually carried information about the actual quantum Hall wave function. Now, so in the context of tensor networks...
So entanglement Hamiltonian is the same as modular Hamiltonian?
I'm not sure what a modular Hamiltonian is, so I will have trouble explaining that.
It's the lattice version of that.
Sorry?
It's the lattice version?
Of, yeah.
Ah, okay.
It's the same thing.
Okay. Right, so kind of the mysterious thing in this whole derivation is that what we look at is really that, so these guys live in the 2D bulk, really, right? On the other hand, this Hamiltonian we get is some one-dimensional Hamiltonian. And in some sense, you could say that this reduction from 2D to 1D comes a bit as a mystery. Like, where does this explicit 1D Hilbert space come from? It kind of pops out of nothing. So now, if you look at tensor network wave functions, there's a very natural 1D space.
This is a 1D CFT on the circle.
Uh-huh. At least an approximate CFT, right? The counting matches the CFT and so forth. I mean, in that case, in this fractional quantum Hall wave function, you kind of put a CFT into the original quantum Hall wave function. You put a CFT correlator and you find the same CFT again. So that's why kind of the CFT in that case is really telling you something about the bulk physics. Because the way you construct it, you put in that CFT, you get it out again in the entanglement. And if you actually cut the system, you would see the same kind of CFT as a dynamics at the edge. It's kind of the dynamics at the edge. So it's kind of all intertwined. Okay. So what happens if I take a tensor network? Let's say this is kind of cut out from the cylinder, this 2D wave function, and I cut my system into two halves. So that's this cut here. So basically, that's what I already described earlier. I have some indices alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3 here, which carry this summation. Right? And for each value alpha, I have some left alpha and some right alpha state here. Well, yes, right now there is no lambda. But so one thing you see is that basically the degrees of freedom, which I called I here, which label the entanglement spectrum, the eigenvalues of the entanglement spectrum, they really live at this edge, right? So this alpha really lives on an actual 1D Hilbert, well, this is an unfortunate notation. When I say 1D Hilbert space, I don't mean a 1D Hilbert space, but I mean the Hilbert space of a 1D spin chain, right?
It's the space of boundary conditions.
It's a space of boundary conditions to the tensor network, if you wish, if you would actually cut it, right? That's actually a good point. This indeed will relate to the actual edge physics. So one thing we get this way is we get an actual 1D Hilbert space of a 1D chain, which allows us to basically, in this formalism, I don't want to go through the math, but we can explicitly derive a boundary state sigma, and from this state sigma, we can compute some entanglement Hamiltonian, which really has an explicit 1D structure. So unlike this derivation, which is kind of based on inferring the 1D structure from the quantum numbers, we can really get directly a one-dimensional Hamiltonian, which indeed turns out that if you compute it numerically, it's indeed a quasi-local Hamiltonian. Again, I haven't talked about symmetries yet, except for momentum, which is kind of obvious here. But whenever we encode a symmetry, we'll also find all the symmetries, so all these quantum numbers will be reflected again in this Hamiltonian. Okay, the second thing we can ask is what happens if we actually cut the system. So again, in resemblance to the Lee Haldane correspondence, if we actually cut our system, we only look at one half our system, what will be the low energy physics at the edge? And here we can kind of make use, for instance, of these parent Hamiltonians. We don't have to, but it's kind of handy. So let's say we cut at this edge here. So now what I can ask is, what are the low energy excitations once I cut such a system? And let's try to look at this parent Hamiltonian. And as I said, the idea of the parent Hamiltonian is only to check if my tensor network is locally built consistent, which is something which is not changed at all by cutting it, right? Because it's still the same tensor network. I just might put a funny boundary condition. But I didn't say anything about boundary conditions, right? Remember, that Hamiltonian only checks if it locally can be built from the right tensors, which by construction it can. So what I can do now is I can attach some boundary condition here. And regardless of what boundary condition I attach, for the specific case of the parent Hamiltonians, I get all zero energy states. So all B will be mapped to some bulk state psi B. That's really a linear map, right? And they're all zero energy states. So this space B here, which is exactly the same space as for the entanglement spectrum, characterizes exactly the low energy excitations which I get by cutting the system. And the expectation is certainly that this is localized around the boundary if correlations decay exponentially in the system, so if the system is gapped. That's not a rigorous statement, but that's certainly the expectation, right? If any change here decays exponentially into the bulk, what I will actually see in my physical system will be that the boundary condition only affects the system close by to the boundary, leaving it in exact zero energy state, and thus parameterizing basically the new excitations at the boundary I get by cutting the system.
So psi b is an eigenstate of the bulk parent Hamiltonian?
For the parent, it's indeed an eigenstate with exact zero energy. Now, you might start perturbing it, and if once you perturb it, you actually get some dynamics within that subspace, right? You can do degenerate perturbation theory. This also tells you that somehow you can get lots of different physics in this kind of subspace, right, depending on what perturbation you put. So in a gapped phase, but the edge physics can be vastly different, depending on kind of small changes in the Hamiltonian, because all you get in the whole physics gap. So the main message I wanted to kind of convey is that we also get a 1D state. So that's, again, the 1D system, which parameterizes the edge physics. And it's really the same system, right? So which tells us why there should be a relation between the two, maybe. Again, as I said, maybe there's no relation because I can be in a gapped phase, right? I will have some non-trivial entanglement spectrum, say in the AKLT model, but see very different behavior. So this really only enters once I go to systems which have special constraints like topological order. I'm not sure I will have time to talk about that, but if you have specific constraints relating to topological order, what this will induce, it will induce a super selection rule on these legs. So if you're interested, you can maybe ask me later. So I will get some super selection rule, so some kind of constraint on the admissible boundary conditions. And the super selection rule will both show up here, restricting the edge dynamics to a certain super selection sector, say fermionic parity. And it will show up here. So the entanglement spectrum will have the same type of constraint. And that's kind of a way to see why there are kind of universal correspondences between the two. But there are no correspondences on the microscopic level. As one can see from the fact that it's strictly zero energy among perturbs, and one gets different physics. Okay, let me say one sentence why probably this is different from what people in gravity or so consider a holographic duality. First of all, we have much more degrees of freedom in the bulk than on the boundary. It's an actual 2D bulk and an actual 1D boundary. So it's not a one-to-one correspondence. It's not that the boundary describes all degrees of freedom in the bulk. It really only describes a low-energy degrees of freedom. It's not a unitary mapping or so. We could make it unitary by kind of, you know, trying to get out the non-unitary part, but in principle, it's not a unitary mapping, right? It might treat different degrees of freedom very differently. If we want a unitary mapping, we probably have to choose very specific tensors, which are basically isometries, which allow us to get like a really unitary one-to-one correspondence. So here we have to be careful kind of how the degrees of freedom here are mapped to the bulk degrees of freedom.
How about locality of the map?
Sorry?
How about the locality of the operators?
Well, it's probably local, which, well, I guess in the ADS sense is not good, right? Completely local. But the intuition would certainly be that it's local, right? It maps degrees of freedom to close by degrees of freedom. To a certain extent, one can do this rigorously using ideas from quasi-adiabatic continuation and so on. If you know how to connect a certain wave function for fixed-point wave functions, one can prove it because they're very simple. And if one can adiabatically or quasi-adiabatically evolve it to a different one, one can show that operators don't spread too much. But in general, it's hard to establish rigorous locality results in these networks, right? Because, you know, there are many paths, things can interfere, and so on.
How about the dependency of the boundary cell be from the deep inside the bulk? If you change the deep inside the bulk, then how does it affect on the bulk?
Well, again, the idea is that for gapped systems, it shouldn't happen, right?
Yeah.
Now, we know that with tensor networks, we can also describe some systems with critical correlations and so on, even for a constant bond dimension. Say d equal 2, we can get critical correlations. These will behave differently, but generically the expectation would be that this doesn't happen. But you can set up more pathological cases or so in which this happens. This probably means that the system wouldn't be stable against perturbations, and you should better choose a different description or mod out that kind of dependency. Okay, so maybe the last 50 minutes I wanted to say a few words about symmetries and standard forms, because that's actually a very powerful tool. And I already kept saying things about symmetries without actually discussing them properly. Okay, so before talking about symmetries, okay, so the initial question is independent of symmetries. It's asking if I have two tensor network descriptions of the same wave function, what's the relation between them? And let me start with the converse. Let me take two tensors A and B, and let's say they're related according to the following equation. There's some matrix Y. If I multiply A with Y and Y inverse from left and right, then it's equal to B. Now what I can do is I can build a tensor network consisting only of Bs in 1D. And well, what I see is I can replace it by this formula, right? So I have this Y inverse, Y A, Y inverse, and so further. So what you see is that whenever these guys are adjacent, Y and Y inverse cancels out. All right? So all the Ys will cancel out if I put it on a ring. So I will be just left with a tensor network consisting only of A's. So this tells me if A and B are related by a gauge transformation of that kind. Then the wave functions, the matrix product states built from A and B will actually be equal, right? So there's some kind of gauge transformation which doesn't affect the wave function. Now the real question is, does the inverse also hold? Or can we characterize under which conditions two tensors A and B give rise to the same wave function? And actually in 1D, the essential message is that it's almost true that the opposite holds. It's not exactly true, because what we first have to do is we have to take A and B and bring it into a standard form, and then this holds. But in essence, given the time, let me focus on the essence. Okay, let's be precise. Okay, so I have psi A equals psi B. Now I can do a canonical transformation from A to an A hat, and B to a B hat, which generates the same wave function. And once I'm in the standard form, which kind of, it removes degrees of freedom which don't add anything to the wave function, which just get canceled out to some global constraint, basically. Once I have this, it holds that A is related via exactly this transformation to B for some Y. That's what we call the fundamental theorem of MPS. I mean, one has to be even a bit more precise, right? It varies a bit if you have proportionality or equality and so on. But that's the essence. The essence is whenever I have two inequivalent descriptions of the same wave function, they're related by a local transformation. Now, why is this relevant? So, okay, let me maybe postpone the 2D. Why is this relevant? Well, it's relevant in particular if I want to know what happens if I describe systems with a symmetry. So let's say I have a global on-site symmetry for a wave function such that if I act with some unitary representation of some group, I get the same wave function back. And this wave function is described by some tensor A. So what I now have is I have one wave function described by A. And I know it's equal to the one described by B. So where I multiply with UG. And so further, now this condition tells me, I can think of this as a new tensor B, right? B is A multiplied by UG. Now the fundamental theorem tells me that this new tensor B, which is A times UG, can be understood as some YG times A times YG inverse. So now one can start asking, what can I say about this YG? Okay, wait. Maybe before I erase. Let me go here. Okay, so now one can ask, what can I say about this YG? Well, what we know is that YG times YG inverse is kind of isomorphic to this UG. So you would basically say that this YG should also form a representation of the same group, pretty much. if that's a representation. But that's not entirely true, because just from this formula, you see that given yg times yg inverse, you can't actually extract yg entirely, right? Because whatever phase I multiply it with, the opposite phase will pop up here, so it will cancel out, right? So this is actually only fixed up to a phase. So yg has this kind of gauge degree of freedom that I can multiply it with a phase. And then, also, it will not form a representation, because I can't claim this from the representation. I can claim that it will be ygh, but only up to a phase. So this is what is known as a projective representation. So the standard example would be the spin 1/2 representation of the rotation group. And it turns out that this property is extremely relevant for understanding the different types of phases we can see subject to a symmetry. Because in the specific case where this would be SO3, the rotation group, this can either be an integer spin or a half integer spin. And these are two fundamentally different classes, right? I mean, they're really distinguished by the different way in which they transform. It turns really out that it's a two-valued object. And this allows to get some results on classification. Of phases under symmetries, so-called SPT, symmetry-protected topological phases. Also, some people say T should be trivial and topological. Anyway, so these fundamental theorems are important because they tell us if we have some symmetry, it doesn't have to be that kind of symmetry. We could take reflection, right? If it would take reflection, then B would be something like A with the two legs swapped. And we can ask the same question. We can ask, we have a gauge transformation. What condition can we get on the gauge transformation? Turns out in that case it's symmetric or antisymmetric, which again are two distinct classes. And this then allows to classify different phases or show stability of different phases subject to symmetries. Okay.
I have a question.
Yes?
When you said this is way to classify SPD phases, Where did you impose the condition that there's no topological order?
It's 1D, right? So.
Oh, you do. Oh, talking 1D.
I mean, it could have a symmetry breaking properties, but that's kind of that you have to mod out beforehand. That's part of the inaccuracy in this statement, right? That if you have long range order, you have to take care of that separately. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it works. I think it's right. Okay. Okay, maybe just some last comments on two dimensions, also since I still have these pictures here. So in 2D, we can do the same thing. We can say that a specific way of having identical wave functions is to take the tensor and demand that it's, once we act with a physical symmetry, so we have a tensor B, and we have this kind of gauge condition, then we see that this kind of gauge condition will again imply that psi of A is psi of B. Now, the converse doesn't hold in general. So we know that the converse holds under certain conditions. We have other conditions under which we can show a more general version, which does not give rise to that, but a more complex relation. That's the one which is relevant, for instance, for symmetry protected phases in two dimensions, so they're not described by this framework. But what this also tells us is that one specific way of encoding symmetry, certainly, is to say that a physical symmetry will again just map to a symmetry on the auxiliary system. And this is nice because it tells you if you encode symmetries this way, any of these symmetries will show up at the boundary here, right? Whenever you have a system with any kind of physical symmetry, there will be a natural symmetry action on the boundary, and the symmetry will be preserved at the boundary, right? So you get all the symmetry labels from the bulk, you get on the boundary in the entanglement and in the edge physics. And that's why you can do all these kind of labelings by symmetry sectors for the entanglement spectrum. You get it immediately for free, basically, from the structure of the space. Now it's 5 to 12, so maybe I should stop, I guess. Yeah, well. Okay. Well, I was a bit sketchy, I guess, especially towards the end. I hope I covered the essentials. I couldn't talk about topological order, but I can spend 2 minutes on it, but it might be a bit short. So maybe another time. Okay, thanks. Yes? Where's my chairman? Who was first? Yes? All right. Oh, my job. Who was first, guys?
Okay. So you mentioned you can encode critical states in a bomb dimension 2 path.
Uh-huh.
So is that generic ones or only sort of the special? Where you're bootstrapping a classical critical state?
Well, the ones I know come from classical.
Yeah.
Wave functions. Oh, we have these chiral wave functions, right? I don't know if they come from classical models, but they're also critical.
Oh, I don't know those. But generic ones you don't know how to get.
Kind of you mean special. Generic 2 plus 1 critical points?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. They're the
with a fixed one dimension, it's not, I don't think you would get generic ones. They'd always be special in some way.
I wonder if there's a group for that.
So in 2D, you mentioned that this kind of relation between a different representation of a state doesn't hold. So this kind of equivalence relation.
Mm-hmm.
So does it have any physical implications when it holds or when it doesn't hold?
Mm-hmm. So basically, if you have this kind of representation of symmetries, then these systems will be trivial as SPT phases in 2D, so as phases where you impose symmetries, for instance. So the ones which are not trivial will have some kind of correlated symmetry actions across the whole column. I mean, one reason to see why this breaks down in 2 dimensions is that this classification of projective representations doesn't work anymore in 2D once you block, right? So if you don't insist on strict translational symmetry, you block two sides, 2 spin 1/2 representations will become an integer spin representation. So this kind of property is not stable. You need a different one, but there is a different one, which is then basically given by a matrix product operator type symmetry action on the whole boundary, which again can be classified up to phases and so on. It's a bit more involved. So there are consequences, yes.
So another question. What if you use a trivalent PEPS?
Fine.
But how do you construct a symmetric PEPS?
Well, lattices are kind of always square. I mean, unit cells, lattice unit cells are always square lattices, right? So obviously there's an A and B sublattice, and you would have to choose different representations on the A and B. That's what I mean. That's, say you do a honeycomb lattice, right? I mean, there's an A and a B sublattice, and you have to choose a kind of... And each unit cell will have one A and one B site, and you might have different representations on those.
But I mean, okay. So that on the, you're saying that the only way to do it would be to come up with a way where you can pair it into pairwise.
I mean, in principle, it's a bit like engaged theories, right? I mean, it's attached to the link, not to the site, the symmetry representation. So you should really think of these actions as attached to links. So I don't really need to put y and y inverse, right? It's just that this tensor has some y, and the tensor left of it on its right leg has y inverse. So the gauge transformation is something sitting on the link, not sitting on the side. And that's the way you should think of it. So you can do it in a completely non-uniform way. Of course, usually it's nicer to have some symmetry. Okay.
Thank you, Robert. Okay, so now